I'm Christine DiMatte, and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Tom Hudson is out this week. Hands down, one of my favorite headlines out of Florida this past week was, quote, "Will Joe Sixpack become Joe Dimebag?" Here to help us answer that question and others, Mark Caputo and Steve Rothaus of the Miami Herald. Gentlemen, hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
And Mike Van Sickler of the Tampa Bay Times. Michael, good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
It's your show, too. Please call us, 1-800-743-WLRN, 743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Well, if a newly released poll is to be believed, an overwhelming majority of Florida voters, 88%, support the idea of legalized medical marijuana. The latest Quinnipiac University numbers are being very closely watched since voters will decide in November whether to legalize medical marijuana. Mark, it was your article that was top with the headline I just mentioned a second ago. Let's talk about that 88% for a second. How much can we rely on that number?
Not much.
What is it closer to?
Well, probably closer to about 70. For some reason, Quinnipiac University insists on asking the wrong poll question. When you poll a proposed constitutional amendment and voters' opinion about it, you should poll the constitutional amendment's language. They don't do that. They ask people, should adults be legally allowed to have medical marijuana? That's different than the specific language of the constitutional amendment. So probably on average, when you see other polls that actually poll the language, medical marijuana in Florida, as asked, reference the constitutional amendment, has anywhere from a low of 62-64% to a high of about 72-74%.
And there are people who take issue with the ballot language. One of them is Kristen Bridges. She's a spokesperson for No on Two.
This poll continues to be a complete outlier in support of medical marijuana because it asks a question that won't be on the ballot. To be clear, Amendment 2 does not require a doctor's prescription.
Yeah. Does not require.
Well, let's take a few at a time. One, you know, Kristen's very nice, and I like Bascom Communications, but they do represent the tobacco industry. We should state that. Secondly, what's fascinating about the inconsistency in the Say No or Vote No on 2 campaign is just a few weeks ago, they were citing the very same Quinnipiac poll question and poll numbers as if it were an authority. Now they say it's crap. Then lastly, you have to look at the broader milieu of things. Yeah, it's an outlier at 88%, but still, it's very popular. And there's a rhetorical trick that the opponents of medical marijuana are using, saying it doesn't allow a doctor to prescribe it. Well, that's because federal rules essentially prohibit a doctor from prescribing it. So they have to write the amendment saying a doctor can recommend it, but it still has to be a written recommendation, and it has to be done following certain medical procedures and rules of medical conduct.
Okay, the same poll also asked voters what they felt about recreational marijuana and the results of that.
Majority, an increasing majority, I think it's about 55% now, support the idea of small personal use and possession of marijuana, not for medical purposes, but again, for personal fun.
Okay, so let's fast forward to the gubernatorial race. How much of a political risk is it when you've got this sort of support for recreational use? I mean, what sort of political risk is there in opposing it?
You know, I really wonder if there is much of one at all. If you start to look at the crosstabs of the various poll questions, you know, Republicans, by rather large percentages, support medical marijuana as asked in various forms, whether it's a constitutional amendment or, you know, for adults only. Yet even higher percentages of them support Governor Rick Scott. I mean, people are capable of holding two different opinions simultaneously, as long as they're not complete contradictions, and sometimes even if they are complete contradictions. But in this case, Republicans like Rick Scott, and Republicans generally like medical marijuana.
Marijuana just likely to be just one of the issues that will be the subject of the gubernatorial debates in October. Something new. Governor Rick Scott says he will participate in three debates that month, which will be after the August Democratic primary. And these debates would be hosted by Telemundo, CNN, and Leadership Florida. Democrat and former Governor Charlie Crist says he wants even more face time with the Republican incumbent.
We can't debate enough because there's a lot to debate about. And it's about the future of Florida, and it's about fundamental fairness. It's about raising the minimum wage. It's about, you know, being fair to women and having equal pay for women. It's about not discriminating against LGBT or anybody else on any other basis.
And Steve, we will be talking about LGBT issues and gay marriage later on in the show. But Mark, addressing Charlie Crist's comments, he says there's a lot to debate when it comes to Rick Scott, but apparently he doesn't feel the same way about former State Senator Nan Rich, who's also running for the Democratic nomination. He has refused any debates with her. So how wise is it for Chris to push all of these extra debates with Rick Scott but not debate Nan Rich?
Well, I don't know if it really hurts him per se against Rick Scott in the aggregate. However, I do think it hurts him to a degree in the Democratic primary. That is, the chances of Charlie Crist losing to Nan Rich, who's little known and has little money, is very slim. However, at a certain point, there is a certain amount of grassroots outreach. There is a certain amount of care and feeding. There is a certain amount of respect that you sometimes want to show your opponent. Nan Rich is a longtime Democrat. Charlie Crist is not.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been made a point, a campaign theme by Nan Rich, for Nan Rich, you know, of her supporters, for many months now. And Chris is just basically letting it happen, and these grassroots supporters are getting more and more angry about it. Right now, there's not a lot of excitement for the Democratic primary, and that's bad heading into a general election for Charlie.
Steve? I mean,
Charlie Crist has nothing to gain by debating Nan Rich.
But he does.
See, I disagree. I think that if he debates Nan Rich, he elevates her in the public eye. He will give her a platform that she doesn't have at this point.
Sure. If he was going to lose to her, that would be understandable. But, I mean, he's going to probably beat her by double digits. Now what he's doing, you're going to see a record low Democratic turnout. If you talk to Democratic insiders and grassroots people, there's not a lot of excitement for Charlie Crist. Having a spirited, not vicious, but having a spirited primary where you discuss the issues helps engage Democrats. The number one problem in midterm elections for the Democratic Party in Florida is Democratic engagement. They disproportionately fall off the rolls. They disproportionately don't show up to vote. And now you have a Democratic primary that, at best, is a snoozer.
Okay, so the Democrats are facing their share of challenges, but so are Republicans, an issue that Rick Scott and some GOP officials are decidedly mum about, particularly this week. Hunting trips partly paid for by U.S. Sugar. Some government watchdogs suspect that these trips may be attempts to get around Florida's gift ban. Mike Van Sickler, you and Craig Pittman broke this story about these trips to King Ranch. This is an expensive hunting ground in Texas. What did you find?
Well, at first, we actually got this tip back during the legislative session when neither Craig or I could jump on it. So we actually started reporting it in June. We immediately found a reluctance to talk about it among many of the lawmakers who we had heard about attending these trips. That's
an understatement. Reading your article,
yeah,
Virtually all of them said, no, we can't talk about it.
I would characterize it as a unified front in not talking to us, which impressed both Craig and I. We were immediately very impressed by the fact that nobody would talk to us. And in fact, every time they refused to talk to us, they kept repeating almost line, word for word, the same line of, you have to talk to the party. We can't talk about this. So immediately we started digging further. And that's when we came up with the idea of if they were hunting in Texas, maybe there's some records in Texas that could actually show us who was actually hunting.
So with
a stroke of luck, we got these records from the Parks and Recreation Department in Texas, which showed us which lawmakers purchased hunting licenses in the past 3 years.
So you sort of cross-reference those hunting licenses with other state records, with Florida state
records? Well, sadly
records?
Enough, the really sad thing is among reporters, we like to talk about how great the public records are in Florida and how open everything is. The weird thing about this story is no records in Florida actually showed us anything about these trips. We had to go out of state. We had to go to Texas to get anything that showed lawmakers were attending anything in Texas.
Mike, this is Steve. Why is that? Is that because this was a trip that they took, through the Republican Party versus through the state of Florida? Why are there no records?
Well, you hit upon the hard part about this story was campaign finance laws. The reporting that's required these days is pretty lax. As you know, there's a gift ban that was passed in 2006 that prohibits any lawmaker from accepting any gift from lobbyists. You can't even accept a cup of coffee. But there's a loophole that allows donors to give however much they want to the parties. And they can't earmark these contributions. They can't say, here's $100,000. I want it to go to, these politicians. They can't give an in-kind contribution and say, I want Will Weatherford to go. But they can give in-kind contributions of, say, $10,000. And the $10,000, the way it's described in public documents is air travel. Well, it doesn't have to tell you where the air travel is. It doesn't tell you for what purpose the air travel is. It only has to say air travel.
So, Mike.
And so, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, let me interrupt you half a second. If state officials are talking to sugar lobbyists during these trips, why is that a problem?
Well, the problem is sugar lobbyists lobby lawmakers, and they actually get quite a lot in laws passed or in policy decisions from the very same lawmakers and officials who were attending these trips. For instance, Representative Matt Caldwell, who purchased a license in 2013, earlier in 2013, he sponsored a bill that kept the cleanup charges on Big Sugar to about $25 per acre, which, if you talk to some environmentalists, they say, well, that's very low, and it could be and it should be much higher, because it's only a fraction of the cost that they're actually creating in the Everglades. So that's an example of, you know, if Big Sugar isn't cleaning up the pollution that they're creating in the Everglades, that's going to be the taxpayers who do that. Now, we can have an open discussion of maybe the taxpayers should pick up those costs. So maybe that's just a good way of encouraging agriculture in this state. But when you have lawmakers who are going to King Ranch with the very same lobbyists and sugar officials who are benefiting from these laws that are being passed later on, I think the public has a right to know that these trips are taking place.
So in the course of your reporting, Mike, you had what is a pretty discomforting experience for any reporter. A door slammed in your face, quite literally. Can you tell us about that? Who did the slamming?
Well, let me correct that quickly. It wasn't slammed in my face.
Was it closed firmly?
Yes.
Closed firmly.
During our conversation, I'm asking Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam just exactly who flew him and who was there with him, because I was curious as a reporter just the extent of this, this, and as he described it, it was a fundraiser for the Republican Party of Florida. So I was just trying to extract as much information as I could. And at the time, his press secretary closed the door. She was very polite about it, if you can be polite about closing a door on someone. So I don't want to leave the impression that there was, if you were there at the scene, it wasn't as dramatic as a door being slammed in my face. Nobody was shouting. Everybody was very polite, okay, including Commissioner Adam Putnam.
Mike Van Sickler of the Tampa Bay Times. We're going to take a little break here. Thank you, Mike. It is your show, too. Please call us, 1-800-743-WLRN. You can tweet us, too. Our Twitter handle is at WLRN. Still to come, we discuss two major court rulings, one on marriage equality, the other a decision that pits Florida gun advocates against health care providers. I'm Christine DiMatte. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're going to talk about two recent court decisions concerning touchstone issues, gay marriage and the right to bear arms. A federal appeals court last week upheld a Florida law that bars doctors from asking patients about gun ownership. So time to ask our listeners, has a doctor or a nurse asked you about firearms at home? And also, healthcare providers out there, if you're listening, please tell us why you think you should or should not be allowed to ask about guns at your patients' homes. You can ring us at 1-800-743-WLRN. Once again, 1-800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. But first, last Friday, a Miami-Dade judge ruled the state's gay marriage ban unconstitutional and ruled that six plaintiff couples should be able to say their I do's in Florida. Joining us once again, Steve Rothaus of the Miami Herald. He covers LGBT issues for the Miami Herald. Steve, it's the second time this month that a South Florida judge has ruled against the gay marriage ban, but nothing can legally happen yet. Why is that?
Well, that's because there is an automatic stay that triggers after a state official loses in court in Florida. The law provides for that. So in each case, the Attorney General's office has lost the case first in Monroe County and then in Miami-Dade County, and that requires the automatic stay, meaning that the couples in this case can't get married.
Do you happen to know if any couples are, regardless, are still booking wedding venues anyway because they are just absolutely confident that they are going to be permitted to marry?
Well, for several years in South Florida, the tourism councils in Fort Lauderdale and Miami-Dade County and in, certainly in the Keys, they've been suggesting to people that they come and celebrate their marriages from out of state or their unions or whatever ceremonies they want to have in Florida. So I don't know that that's particularly changed, but there is certainly a business behind that, and that it's been a very popular destination for some people to come here and spend their time after they've had a commitment ceremony or they've been married somewhere else.
Okay, legal challenges pending to in favor of dropping the ban. Am I right?
Well, right. I mean, there are several legal changes. First, we've got these right to marry cases, and that those are couples who are suing to get married in Florida. And then we have the cases of now it's about a dozen or so couples who are fighting to have their out-of-state marriages recognized by the state of Florida. Ultimately, it all comes back to 2008's constitutional amendment that banned the state from performing or recognizing marriages or civil unions.
Okay, and just a second ago we were talking about medical marijuana and ramifications for the gubernatorial race. Let's talk about marriage equality issues and the political consequences there.
Well, I think that certainly the governor has avoided it all possible from discussing this topic. Michael Putney broadcast an interview in which he asked the governor several times what his personal opinion was on marriage equality, and the governor said, each time, well, I support, he said, I do not support, I support traditional marriage, is the way he put it. But he also said that I don't believe people should be discriminated against.
And Mark Caputo, you were smiling just a half a second ago.
I was going to say it's an understatement that he's kind of avoided answering the questions. After that Putney interview that Rick Scott gave, we had Amy Sherman of the Miami Herald and PolitiFact Florida follow up a few days later with the question, okay, well, you say you're against discrimination. Well, which discrimination are you against? There are gay rights supporters and those of that ilk say that it is discriminatory to ban gay couples from getting married, same-sex couples from getting married. However, the supporters of the constitutional amendment say they're being discriminated against by a judge throwing out their vote. Mm-hmm. So which discrimination are you opposed to? And he said, I'm against discrimination. So we're not going to be, he's not going to answer the question.
And how about Charlie Crist?
Charlie Crist is certainly answering the question. I mean, I don't know how well this translates into support for a candidate at the polls. Remember, in 2008, 62% of people voted for
right.
this. However, polling now indicates that a majority, I don't think a supermajority yet, generally speaking in Florida, now believe that gay marriage or same-sex civil union should be permitted. However, there is a benefit to Charlie Crist in adopting this stance, which, by the way, is a flip-flop.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of gay rights activists and same-sex couples and gay people who have a lot of money, and they want to contribute to him, and he has really helped, advocate on their behalf.
And Democratic gubernatorial candidate Nan Rich, she certainly hopes Democratic voters will remember Charlie Crist's earlier position on LGBT marriage rights.
He has changed his opinion on this, as he has on many other things, but for 7 years that I ran the gay adoption bill, he was against gay adoption. And now he's for it, and now he's okay. And marriage equality, he made quite a big statement about signing the petition, the constitutional amendment petition, to ban marriage equality.
Well, Chris has bent over backwards to apologize for that, you know, support back in 2008 for the constitutional amendment. You know, to say it's a flip-flop, well, can you say that Obama flip-flopped?
Yes.
I mean, the fact is, well,
Marxist,
you know, the other people's minds change. And, you know, the truth is that Nan Rich has been with the gay community for many, many years, very supportive of LGBT issues. And that's why there are many people, in particularly in Broward County, in her home base, who are, you know, very upset that groups like Equality Florida have decided to support Charlie Crist.
And Steve, a half a second ago, you mentioned, you made a reference to divorce and civil unions. While same-sex couples are rallying for the right to get hitched in Florida, some are also trying to separate. And one woman is asking a Broward County judge to overturn the gay marriage ban to get out of her civil union in Vermont. Can you tell us about that case?
Well, yes. In 2002, a woman named Heather Brassner, she had a civil union in Vermont with her then partner, Megan Lade. And back in 2002, there were no states that were performing marriages. Massachusetts became the first state in 2004, and I believe it wasn't until 2009 that Vermont actually began performing marriages for same-sex couples. But anyway, in any event, these two women had their civil union, but then they broke up about 4 years ago. And Megan has pretty much disappeared. Heather has no idea where she is. In the meantime, she has now entered into a relationship with another woman, and now she would like to get married, but she can't because she is still civilly united with her first partner in Vermont. Vermont will not dissolve the civil union because the ex-partner is not available to sign papers that they've been able to work out their separation. So as a result, she'd like to get divorced, have her civil union dissolved in Broward County. You know, she lives in Lake Worth. But the problem here is that the state of Florida will not recognize the civil union. Therefore, it will not perform the divorce.
So bottom line is, the homosexual couples, LGBT couples, have the same mishigas when it comes to marriage and divorce that heterosexual couples do.
Absolutely. That's what Elizabeth Schwartz, who's one of the attorneys for the plaintiff couples in one of the cases, she refers to that as being wedlocked.
I wanted to go back on the gay adoption issue. You know, it's certainly difficult to say that Charlie Crist has not flip-flopped and reinvented history regarding his view with same-sex couples. Nan Rich, however, is also reinventing history with Charlie Crist vis-a-vis the ban on gay adoptions.
Mm-hmm.
Crist, when he was governor in 2010, celebrated when a district court of appeal blocked Florida's ban on gay adoptions. Crist stopped challenging it as governor, and he celebrated the ruling. So we can trace his opposition to Florida's gay adoption ban to 2010. So for Rich to suggest that this is a newfound thing, well, it's at least 4 years old.
Okay. Encyclopedic knowledge of Florida politics, Mark Caputo. And in another hot-button issue for the governor's race, a federal appeals court ruled last week that a state law prohibiting doctors from asking patients about gun ownership was valid. The court said the decision, quote, simply acknowledges that the practice of good medicine does not require interrogation about irrelevant private matters. Now, medical groups say the ruling threatens their ability to treat and protect their patients and chills their right to free speech. Mark, Florida was the first, you correct me if I'm wrong, Florida was the first in the nation to pass this kind of law?
I believe that's the case, and that this came up in other states and it didn't happen. Understand, the original proposal as brought by the NRA was really onerous and really prohibited doctors from even asking or talking about firearms in general or in specific. However, the Florida Medical Association, through its might in Tallahassee in 2011, had this bill watered down. The law does not prohibit doctors from discussing firearms. It does generally prohibit them from asking if someone has a firearm in a home. So if you have a child and you go to a pediatrician, the doctor, even under this law, is still allowed to say, look, if you have a firearm in the home, please make sure it's locked up and that it's stored. Now, the law spooks pediatricians because it does give new kind of causes of actions and potential fines for people who say they're quote unquote being harassed by this topic generally coming up. And that's their fear. So this is a First Amendment versus Second Amendment fight, the so-called Docs and Glocks bill.
Right. And we're going to take a call from... Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was just going to ask, are there any other restrictions on doctors as to things that they cannot ask patients?
That's a great question. I don't believe so. However, there are restrictions on doctors perhaps discussing with patients things in an unprofessional manner. And so the legislature has essentially recodified that. That said, what you do have here is you have a law from the NRA that was essentially finding a problem that wasn't really widespread and an issue that wasn't really widespread. And NRA is just like any other lobby. It needs to develop and deliver wins to its membership. It did it again in 2011.
When this was overruled last year, Marsha Cook said it was based on anecdotal evidence. Is that going to be a weakness with the law moving forward?
That's a good question. I'm surprised that the three-judge panel ruled this way. It's going to be appealed en banc, and my suspicion is, relative to everything else, this, my guess is that the law will once again be thrown out once the entire appeals court rules on it, the circuit court.
Okay, we've got a call from Matt calling in from Hollywood. He's got a question. Matt, hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Great, how are you doing?
Good. Well, I just, about this whole the guns and the doctors thing, my uncle lives up in Central Florida, and he was put on a clinical trial for this drug. I forget what it was treating for, but one of the symptoms was like, or the side effects was severe depression, and he had a lot of firearms in his home. And the judge pretty much told him that either to get rid of them or to live somewhere else, and he ended up living on a different property that they owned in a trailer for the year and a half that he was on this medication. And I was just wondering, like, because I know there's a lot of medications that have depression as side effects, and if you have a gun in your house, I feel like the doctor should know that if they're going to prescribe you one of these drugs.
Right. Thank you, Matt. A very, very good question. Very interesting. We've talked about pediatricians. We talk about kids and guns in the house. What about mental illness, depression? I mean, does the same thing apply as it does for pediatricians?
Yeah, this applies to all doctors. Again, there is a fine distinction between the doctor asking about it and just saying, look, if you do have a gun in the home, do X, Y, and Z. Or my reading of the statute, I'm not a lawyer, but my reading of the statute and seeing how it was formed, it technically would not prohibit a doctor from saying, look, I'm giving you Strattera. This can sometimes give you violent ideations. If you have a firearm, please get rid of it. I don't see that as running afoul of the law. However, I do see the doctor running afoul of the law if he says, do you have a gun in the home? So that's a fine distinction, and you could see why it spooks some doctors, lots of doctors.
No, but if you had narcotics in the home also that were prescribed and the doctor then gave you a medication that could cause you to become depressed, I mean, it would be the same thing. You know, would you say to that person, get rid of those narcotics, or do you have, I mean, to me, there's not much difference than you know, asking about a gun.
We reached out to the Public Insight Network for some comments. Here's one from Gerald from Miami. He is a physician who says he is also a gun owner, and he writes, the possession of guns by individuals prone to misuse them because of a medical condition is a healthcare issue. The passage of legislation forbidding physicians to do their jobs regarding gun ownership and medical conditions is a major issue, and I see Steve Rothaus is nodding here.
Well, no, I was just going to say that, you know, I particularly enjoyed, a New York Times columnist who said that he didn't quite get the fact that his doctor could ask him his sexual history, and that, you know, he could say to him, you know, are you having sex with your wife? Are you having sex with other people? And that this not be, you know, in an invasive kind of question, but in the context of the doctor asking him for his health. Yet he feels that in Florida that if a doctor asked if he owned a gun, that that would now be illegal.
We also had a comment, George from Fort Lauderdale. He's a gun owner who has had a doctor ask if he owned firearms. And George from Fort Lauderdale writes, my four-year-old's pediatricians sometimes ask this question. I believe it is an appropriate question, as they also ask whether we own a pool, a swimming pool. Both are risk to children, though pools are much riskier.
Very true. If you own a gun and a pool and you have a child, your child is far more likely to die in the pool than by a firearm.
Also, Michael from Homestead, interesting. He's also a gun owner, and he writes, no, if they did, I'd tell them it's none of their business, inappropriate for them to ask. It has nothing to do with my physical or my mental health.
There you go. You have to question whether the doctor wants to have them as a patient. However, the doctor under the law can't get rid of him or has difficulty getting rid of him as a patient because the law also says that a doctor can't get rid of someone solely based on their recalcitrance in answering or discussing firearms. That said, it's now left up to interpretation as to why the doctor no longer will see you now. I do find another bit of an irony in this law when it was passed. One of the cases, perhaps irony is the wrong word, one of the cases was from a Medicaid patient who complained about a Medicaid-paid pediatrician asking about firearms. If you think about doctors who receive Medicaid, they're basically performing charity care in their own time, is coming out of their own pocket, because right. The Florida legislature ratchets down Medicaid reimbursement so low that they're basically losing money, the doctors are, in seeing these people. So here was a doctor seeing someone essentially on his own dime, asked this question, and the guy runs to the NRA and then the news media saying that this is an inappropriate and wrong. Well, you know, if you ask me, in the free market, and I'm a doctor, I really might want to look twice about having a patient like that on my patient list.
And on the flip side, it's also quite acceptable for a patient to fire his doctor.
Mark Caputo and Steve Rothaus, thank you very much. We need to take a short break. Now, when we return, a local street artist goes head-to-head with a major clothing retailer who says they are using his work in their advertising. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte. Wynwood draws crowds of people from around the world to look at the street art on its walls. And one group that the art has attracted, the marketing folks from retailer American Eagle Outfitters. David, you got to help me out with this, Carlos. Anasagasti, right? he's a popular Miami street artist known as A-Hole Sniffs Glue. We'll talk about that name a little later. He is suing the retailer for using his murals without compensating or crediting him. This could prove to be a landmark case for the rights of artists. Joining me now in the studio, Carlos Suarez de Jesus. He's an art critic for the Miami New Times. Welcome, Carlos.
Welcome, Chris. Great to be here.
And on the line, Philippa Loengard. She is an assistant director of Columbia University's Center for Law, Media, and the Arts. And she joins us now from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. Philippa, it's good to have you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Carlos, tell us about this case. How did this all happen?
Well, American Eagle was here in Miami in February for a photo shoot. They actually hired a local company and seven mural painters to paint murals for a spring break campaign. But apparently after that happened, they scrubbed the work that they had paid, you know, to use and to incorporate in their ad campaign. And they apparently, you know, discovered A-Hole's mural over on Northwest 27th Street and decided that it was a great way, because of his iconic eyes, to generate eyeballs.
And that's what the mural has, a whole bunch of eyeballs.
It's an expansive collection of overlapped droopy eyeballs that are the artist's signature, you know, trademark.
And once again, I love this name, David Anasagasti.
Anasagasti. It's
Basque, very interesting. But the artist formerly known as A-Hole Sniffs Glue. And I have to tell you that this is a red letter. Mark Caputo is laughing at me right now.
I can't help myself.
This is a red letter day for me as a broadcaster to be able to say A-Hole Sniffs Glue on the air. Okay, but how popular is he, is David?
David's very popular in Miami. He's been you know, painting his murals on streets and, you know, everywhere from Wynwood to South Miami, the beach, at Standard Hotel, everywhere. And he's extremely well known. The New Times this year recognized him as Miami's best street artist. We have an annual mastermind award that we give out to local talent, you know, create Miami 305 creatives. And he's been mentioned several times. So he's very popular and well known.
And something like this, where an artist claims that a major company is, quote unquote, stealing their artwork. I mean, how often does this happen for our local street artists? Is this a common occurrence?
Yes, it happens frequently. And when I was reporting on the story, I reached out to Books for Bishop over at Primary Projects, the downtown gallery. But Bishop was also responsible for organizing Primary Flight, the initiative that generated the first wave of commissioned murals in Wynwood. And he said to me that that happens quite frequently, and you know that everyone's looking at David's case because it could set a precedent that is going to impact Miami artists.
Philippa Loengard, please help us understand the legal context here. I know you're not working on this particular case, but based on what you've read, does the artist have a strong legal claim?
Absolutely. I mean, based on what I've read, and I haven't heard any response from American Eagle, and I don't know all of the facts, but based on the information that's out in the media right now, absolutely. And I'm going to say David because I can neither do the last name nor the pseudonym, if that's okay. But you automatically have a copyright in a work once you create it. Even if it's on the wall of a building, and even if it was done illegally, you might not have the right to prevent the work from being destroyed if it's done illegally, but you absolutely have a copyright in the work, and you have the right to license it, and someone does not have the right to come and take a picture of it and use it in any way, let alone in a commercial way. I mean, this was clearly done for commercial good.
And
so here...
Yeah, go ahead, yeah. Philippa. Go ahead, continue.
No, so here it's a very strong case against someone coming in, knowing that the art is copyrighted, apparently knowing how to contact the artist, not doing so, and then using it for commercial purposes.
Now, it's very important, and it could be historic, because Philippa, you work in New York, and a lot of street artists, I can name one, Jean-Michel Basquiat, he started out as a street artist, and that's the way he was getting publicized at first. So is this an unusual case? Have you seen something of this sort in New York, at least?
Well, I think we need to distinguish this between a regular copyright case, which it is, and a, quote, street art case. There are lots of cases regarding graffiti and whether or not those are protected under what's called the Visual Artists' Rights Act. That's not the case here. The question is not the actual artwork on the building. The question is a reproduction of that work. So it's a straight copyright case. It's the same as if the image had been hanging in a gallery. It's the reproduction and distribution, both rights under the Copyright Act that solely belong to the creator unless they've been assigned. And so in terms of street art, in terms of some of the cases that we think of when we're talking about graffiti, especially in New York, which does have a very active graffiti population, those tend to come under the Visual Artists' Rights Act and the desire to preserve the graffiti in the location where it is. This is a little different from that.
And Carlos, explain to us what exactly David claims happened to his work, those droopy eyes, the murals that you just described. What happened? How is American Eagle using it?
Well, you know, to me, this is a, you know, a clear-cut case of imitation versus inspiration. American Eagle took pictures of a model in front of his, you know, mural on 27th Street in Wynwood, and posed the model with a spray can, a blue spray can, which is the color, the dominant color of the mural, as if implying that the artist, that the model was the artist who had painted the mural. And then they took pictures of people dressed in their spring fashion line, leapfrogging a hydrant in front of the mural. Then they went on and used all of these images in on billboards in Houston Street and Broadway in New York. They used it in-store displays. They used it on the on their webpage, you know, above the fold, the first thing you saw when they were selling the line. But more egregiously, at a store opening in Medellin, Colombia, they actually hired three local graffiti artists to replicate David's work on an 8-foot panel during the opening. And to add to what they were doing, talk about original and derivative, they slapped the American Eagle logo over the replicated eyes that David is known for. And they used that in public relations campaign. It's really...
shameful.
Know, yeah.
But this is a question for both of you now, Philippa and Carlos. Isn't this the risk that any street artist runs when you make the public, you make the street your canvas? If you put
From the legal...
Yeah, go ahead, Philippa.
From the legal perspective, absolutely not. You have a right as a creator to put your art out, whether it be visual art, literature, whatever, in any format that you want. I mean, that would be like saying, well, I wrote an article for a daily paper that's handed out on the subway, and therefore I knew people would have access to it. It is an artist's prerogative to use whatever media he or she wishes. And it's also his right to protect that. I do want to note one thing, and that is that there would be a VARA claim in here, and this is what Carlos was alluding to, of the right of attribution. So when American Eagle tries to intimate that they or their employee or someone random created the art, David has another case on that. He has a right to assert that, hey, he made that art and that it was copied without his permission.
I want to address that issue. That's a very valid point, Philippa. One of the things that's really troubling about this is that when American Eagle sent their crew here to do the mural where they did the ad campaign in Wynwood, the person that was working as a consultant for them was Megan Coleman, who was at one point the art director for Goldman Properties that own a lot of the buildings in the Wynwood area where murals are painted. And actually, you know, Wynwood today is considered an outdoor museum. A lot of these artists, international alone, from Shepard Fairey to Ron English to A-Hole and others here locally, have been hired or commissioned to do these works, and they're out there. But, you know, sadly, I don't understand why American Eagle didn't contact David for permission, because Coleman, as a curator for Goldman Properties, was aware and knew everybody in, you know, Miami, South Florida, whatever. And she must have looked at the website when her artists were not used, and all of a sudden she see David's work. American Eagle could have easily contacted David and avoided this problem. But,
I mean, you know the answer to that question. They're greedy, and they don't care about artists.
And bringing up a point you mentioned earlier, you know, about mentioning his artist pseudonym, perhaps his name played a role in them not maybe contacting or using them.
Because tough
they want
luck.
To be like, if you look at the models they use, they're very Justin Bieber-like, you know, scrub clean and not your typical, you know, what people think of a graffiti art.
I think if we can say a hole on WLRN, I think that American Eagle could have certainly put that someplace in its advertising.
They could have given him some money and they didn't. And they didn't because they're greedy. They probably want to sell clothes made by children to people here for too much money.
Carlos and Philippa, this is for both of you now. I'm going to play devil's advocate just half a second. Street artists have a reputation for being anti-establishment, so aren't we presented with a bit of a paradox here? We've got, you know, the purpose of street art, which is challenges property rights and ownership and all those things, and then we've got street artists all of a sudden turning around and saying, hey, this is mine, hands off, I want money.
Well, I'd like to make a comment. During the course of reporting the story and then like the incredible amount of international stories that have come out about this case, obviously there's public interest. During the time, efforts to reach American Eagle on this case have failed. They have offered no comment. But ironically, I saw something on the internet today where they had one of their spokesperson talking about a current project where they partner with Budweiser for the American Made in America Festival on Labor Day. And that's being headlined by Kanye West, Pharrell Williams, and Jay-Z, you know, artists that also deal with issues of the street, you know, and that type of stuff or whatever. I guarantee you, they didn't pay David and they need to, but I'm sure that Kanye West, Pharrell Williams, and Jay-Z are getting paid.
Okay, Carlos, do you have what are other street artists saying about this? Are they safeguarding their work a little better or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, and they're following the case closely. I think it's important. When I first reported the story, I spoke to Babacar Embo, who's the new appointed director over at the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami, and he was pretty outraged and said that everybody in Miami is going to be following this closely. He said that the museum needed to deal with this on an institutional level, and he's organizing a symposium in October to address the issue. This is something that cuts very close to Miami artists. One thing I wanted to mention really quick is not only did they come in and use A-Hole's work, but the original campaign, if you see the murals that were painted, they say, the art, this city. So they also came into Miami looking at Wynwood as a canvas, you know, to create this urban gritty vibe to sell their product. You know, not only, you know, they're taking advantage of A-Hole's work, but, you know, they're showing a little bit of disrespect to Miami.
Very, very interesting case. It'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. Carlos Suarez de Jesus, art critic for the Miami New Times, and Philippa Loengard, she's an assistant director of Columbia University's Center for Law, Media, and the Arts. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We now shift gears from arts to education. Today marks the beginning of a three-day sales tax holiday for back-to-school shopping. Sorry, kids. Kids may be dreading the approach of school, some of them, at least. Palm Beach and Broward County school boards announced that some schools will need to keep kids in school a little longer. 32 elementary schools in Broward, 27 in Palm Beach County will be adding an hour of instruction for reading because, unfortunately, they fell on the state's new list of 300 lowest-performing elementary schools. And here to tell us more about that, WLRN Miami Herald education reporter John O'Connor. John, it's great to have you in here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what evidence do we have that a longer school day is going to lead to better performance?
Well, the evidence for this specific program in Florida, which was created by lawmakers a couple years ago, the Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability here in Florida did a review of it last year. And so they asked three questions, which were, did the schools move off the low-performing list? Did the test results, students show results in their tests, improvement in their test results, excuse me, and did students at schools with the extra hour of reading do better than students peers at similar schools? And so the answers to the first two questions were clearly yes. Test scores improved. Most of the schools, about 73 of the 100 or so schools that were on the list, moved off that list. But the answer to the third question was a little less clear. Some students did better than students at peer schools. Others did not. It was about 50-50, a little more slanted towards the side of the extra hour of reading, but no clear conclusions as to whether or not this program benefited students more than peer schools.
And how do generally parents and teachers feel about this extra hour?
Well, I don't think you'll get, you ask 100 people and you'll probably get 100 different answers. Mm-hmm. We have seen among school administrators some support for this program. They see that it works. In Duval County, for instance, the school district there, when they see some downward trending schools, some schools where it has been clear for a couple years that the school grades and the test results are declining, they've put in this extra hour of reading without being required to do it. So the superintendent there thinks it works. The review last year found that some of the schools that were mandated to do an extra hour of reading actually kept it, even though they weren't supposed to do it. But we've also seen a lot of districts and parents who have kind of revolted against the idea. Pasco County schools tried to get around having to actually add an extra hour until the State Department of Education came in last week and said, no, you need to add the hour. You can't just increase the amount of instruction time during the regular day. And Duval County schools heard from some parents last week or earlier this week that they didn't like the extra hour. There's also been some districts that have tried this. Connecticut, a district tried it, added 90 minutes to the school day, and then abandoned the idea later because they found it was just too much for the kids to handle.
Okay, and at the same time, Miami-Dade considering having some of its high schoolers grab some extra sleep. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is something that we're seeing across Florida. There was even a lawmaker who proposed a bill that would have required high schools to start later in the day. It's based on some research that came out earlier this year from the University of Minnesota that found that because of biological changes in adolescence, it becomes almost impossible for them to get 8 hours of sleep if school starts at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning. And so Miami-Dade is looking at a pilot program to push the start time back. They're still considering it. We don't have any specifics yet, but it's something you're likely to see in a lot of school districts around Florida.
And they'll be able to hit that snooze button. WLRN education reporter John O'Connor, thank you very much. And that's all the time we have for today's Florida Roundup for Friday, August 1st, 2014. A big thank you to all our guests today. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. And we're posting it on our website, WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup, produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Steph Farrow. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mayers. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Christine DiMattei, sitting in for Tom Hudson this week. Thanks for listening.